Scotland. Renowned for its castles, lochs, wildlife, and stunning scenery. It's also a country that boasts a rich and proud history, from Mary, Queen of Scots, to the Battle of Culloden.
But for me, as an ancient historian, what's even more fascinating is when you go further back in time, beyond Scotland's written history, when you delve into this land's prehistoric past and the many mysteries still surrounding it.
Over three episodes, I'm going on a journey across Scotland to explore its distant past. With the help of leading experts along the way, I'll investigate the evidence. Monumental architecture constructed thousands of years ago.
A level of building that would be challenging to any master builder today, that's for sure.
New archaeological excavations unearthing the huge influence of this land.
When you look at the map of Britain and see Orkney at that kind of pivotal position, it's almost like turning the map of Britain on its head.
And incredible discoveries that are revealing who these ancient people were, how they lived, and how they interacted with a much wider prehistoric world.
Join me as we explore the extraordinary, enigmatic world of prehistoric Scotland.
To start the series, I'm exploring the Stone Age. I'm heading for one of the richest areas of prehistoric archaeology anywhere in Scotland. Orkney, a group of islands that lie off Britain's north coast.
Today, it's easy to see Orkney as a place very much on the periphery, on the northern edge of the British Isles, far away from bustling international centres such as Edinburgh and London. But 5,000 years ago, it was a completely different story. Back then, this group of islands was right at the heart of things, a key part of an interconnected, vibrant Stone Age world, rich in stunning art and architecture.
Today, Orkney is famous for monumental prehistoric structures, from formidable standing stones to some of the most impressive late Stone Age or Neolithic tombs found anywhere in the world, built to last.
Now, the Stone Age structures themselves are fascinating, and we'll get to them. But I'm also keen to discover what we can find out about the prehistoric men and women who lived here on these islands. What has the archaeology revealed about how they lived, about what they thought and believed in?
The Neolithic period in Orkney stretched almost 2,000 years, roughly between 4,000 and 2,500 BC. It's a large period in prehistory and an incredibly significant one, a period which witnessed one of the most important transitions in human history, when the people living here put aside their preceding hunter-gatherer lifestyle and adopted a more sedentary one, centred on agriculture. The people here became farmers. An expert on the lives and beliefs of these early farmers is archaeologist Dr. Antonia Thomas. She's taking me to one of the oldest structures in Orkney.
Wow. Antonia, it's such an incredible, albeit slightly eerie, space. What exactly is this structure?
Well, this is what we call a chambered cairn. This is a burial site, an early Neolithic burial site, where people would have been laid to rest and buried. Its architecture is kind of typical of what we call the early Neolithic in Orkney, and so the mid-4th millennium BC, around 3500 BC. What characterises it is these big upright slabs that sort of divide off the space all the way around it. And these are what we call stalls or orthostats, and this is what we call a stalled cairn. It's a particular type of building from this time.
When do we think the Neolithic arrives in Orkney?
Well, Orkney's Neolithic is obviously like world famous, and we really kind of characterise it by these huge stone buildings. But what happened before that is a little bit of a mystery, and how that Neolithic emerged and appeared is still slightly fuzzy. What we do know is that people were here in the Mesolithic, and the Mesolithic is the period immediately preceding the Neolithic. It's the time of hunter-gatherers, when people were mobile, they were moving around the landscape, they weren't building permanent homes. And we have very little evidence from that time, really. An analogy that's often used is the needle in a haystack, and you'll hear that again and again, but it's absolutely so true. And we actually don't really know what was happening until around 3600, 3500 BC, when we start to see things like this appear.
The creation of grand structures such as Unston Cairn epitomised this seismic shift in human behaviour, when the people living in Orkney abandoned hunter-gathering and embraced farming.
And it's a huge, huge shift. It's not just a shift in patterns of life, but a whole kind of the conceptual way of thinking about the world. If you think about that change between moving around the landscape, hunting and fishing, and then settling down, farming, domesticating cattle, domesticating crops, building permanent homes for yourself, for the living, but also for the dead.
Archaeological discoveries suggest that the houses of these first Neolithic farmers were made out of wood, but they created tombs like Unston out of stone. It required a huge amount of labour to build such permanent structures, which begs the all-important question, who would have been buried here? Were these tombs built for an elite part of society?
We only ever have a snapshot of a population or of a time in archaeology, so we don't really know if it represents the whole of the population. And a lot of these sites were excavated in the 19th century or before, and maybe the records kept weren't as methodical as they would be today, so we have lost a lot of evidence. We do know that the way people were buried in these Neolithic tombs, people were not all laid to rest as individuals in the way that they do in later periods, but they were actually kind of, their bones were disarticulated, they weren't joined together, and they were jumbled up. It kind of highlights, perhaps, kind of how their society was structured. So there's a certain equality in death. So it does kind of, it is suggestive of a kind of communal society. Once people were laid to rest, that wasn't the final say, if you like. So what it does indicate is that these structures weren't just a final place of rest, a burial place in the way we might think about it, but were actually sites for all sorts of rituals and performances, gatherings and different activities that perhaps went on for several generations, perhaps even for another millennium or more. And this site is a good example of that, because we do have evidence for later activity here.
Tombs like Unston were the monumental buildings of Orkney's early Neolithic. They were places of burial and ritual, entered again and again by Stone Age people for centuries after their initial construction.
These stalled structures are some of the earliest buildings that survive from Neolithic Orkney. But there's more to the story than just the building itself, because it was from within cairns like this one at Unston that archaeologists discovered a certain artifact that has now become closely entwined with the early Neolithic in Orkney, with these first Orcadian farmers.
This object was a beautifully crafted type of pottery, found again and again in early Neolithic tombs all across Orkney. To learn more about it, I've come to the National Museum of Scotland's Collection Centre to meet curator Dr. Hugo Anderson Wymark.
Hugo, we've got this incredible array of artefacts right here, but what sort of artefacts were found in a cairn like Unston?
Well, Unston, it's these artefacts we have on the end here. And when it was excavated in 1885, they dug through this very rich black charcoal-rich layer, and amongst it were lots of sherds of pottery, all broken up, a few flint tools, some animal bones, and human remains as well. But the pottery was the thing that this tomb really came to be known for. You can see they're very big sherds. They've been put together here, but that's because there were whole vessels just crushed into this deposit. More than 20 vessels.
More than 20 just in that one can.
Yes, and a good number managed to go back together to relatively complete vessels. And this was the first time this ceramic style had really been found in this quantity. And they realised it was a form of vessel they hadn't found before. And so this style of pottery has become known as Unston Bowl, after the tomb.
It's when you look closer at these bowls that you recognise their high quality.
I can see there's some decorations on the side of this pottery. I mean, talk me through some of the details of it.
This style of bowl is characterised by having this slightly concave neck here, a very pronounced shoulder, and then being quite a shallow, open bowl. And so this style of pottery developed through the Neolithic and ultimately ended up in this form in Orkney and the Outer Hebrides. So we tend to find it just around that very north and west part of Scotland. But it's wonderfully decorated. They often went for a triangular pattern around the rim. And can you see, it's what we call a drag and stab technique. You take a sharp bone or wooden point and you drag it along and stab it back. And so you end up with this very distinctive pattern along the
There's
edge.
There's indented long diagonal lines, aren't they?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. And it's really exquisite. They went for a whole variety. You see a slightly different decoration on that one, but, you know, a similar style. So incredibly finely worked, and they often burnish the surface as well. So they're very smooth, very good quality pots.
And what can these pots, what can they tell us about these early Neolithic people who would have been buried in a cairn like Unston?
They probably went in there with different foods in them as offerings for the people who died. They may well have been consumed to some degree by the people who were at the ceremonies as well. We don't quite know. Obviously very important to the communities who had them. They spent a great deal of care making them and a great deal of care in how they deposited them in that tomb.
The 4th millennium BC marked the start of the Neolithic period in Orkney, with the construction of timber houses and stone-stalled cairns like this one. But this was only the beginning. Much more was still to come.
As the 4th millennium reached its end and the 3rd millennium began, these Neolithic Orcadians started to build even grander new types of monuments on Orkney. Monuments that today stand among the most iconic from the Neolithic period. It was the dawn of the megaliths, the great stones. These are the stones of Stenness, one of the oldest stone circles we know of from Western Europe. Originally, this circle consisted of 12 separate huge stones. Only four remain upright today, but standing next to them on this exposed plain, you can still get a sense of their monumental scale. As not far away from these stones, you can see the remains of an equally astounding Neolithic monument.
I've come to one of the most impressive stone circles in the British Isles, the biggest in Scotland. This is the Ring of Brodgar. The ring itself consists of a lot of large standing stones. Walking around it now, you start to get a sense of its size and its scale. But it's most impressive when you see it from the air.
It's an incredible structure. To learn more about it, I'm meeting Professor Jane Downes.
Jane, this seems to be almost the pinnacle of stone circles in Scotland. It's such a massive construction. And what have excavations here revealed about its date?
The date of the Ring of Brodgar has always been a big problem as to what it is, because Colin Renfrew excavated here in the 70s and didn't get any datable material. So Colin Richards and myself excavated his trenches and we found no charcoal, but we used a different method of dating. So we think the ring was dug around 2500 or 2600 BC.
So this massive stone circle, it's quite late in the story of Neolithic Orkney.
Yes, it is. It's right at the end of the Stone Age, or what we call into the Chalcolithic, or beginning of the Bronze Age, really.
And so how many stones were there here in total?
There were originally thought to be 60 stones, of which some had been taken away, presumably for things like building a stone field wall, and they had all fallen over. So the ones that you see stood up now have been stood back in the original places to reform the monument again.
The ring didn't exist in isolation. Surrounding the stones was a massive ditch, separating the circle from the rest of the landscape.
The ditch is incredibly wide and incredibly deep, so we can see it's quite substantial. And then when we dug through all the deposits, it's rock cut, and it's another few meters deep on top of what we're seeing here. So it's a really substantial feature. And in its day, being rock cut, when we re-excavated, it just shines white, silvery colour. So it must have looked really, really impressive. As much as the stones, it would have been the ditch that would have cut people off, you know, formed a really definite boundary to say that this was a more sacred area.
Each standing stone is called a monolith. And as you look closer, you notice a lot of variation between them in their shape, colour, and texture. These prehistoric people didn't source all of these monoliths from the same quarry, but from several different ones, one of which I'm heading to now.
I'm currently on my way to a hill called Vestra Fjord. It's a site of one of these ancient quarries, a source for this island's iconic Neolithic standing stones.
As you make your way up the hillside, you start to notice horizontal outcrops of stone. It was here that Neolithic Orcadians ventured to source their great monoliths for the Ring of Brodgar.
Now you'll notice how these sandstone outcrops run diagonally up the hill, parallel with the bedding plain below. This, combined with several other factors, such as the distance between these sideways fault lines, made them an ideal place for Neolithic people looking to pry away large slabs of sandstone. A key tool that these people would have been using to extract these slabs were hammer stones, basically pieces of stone that could fit in the palm of your hand that they would use again and again to bash the outcrop until they started to make their mark. Using tools like this, it's hard to fathom just how much time and effort it would have taken just to extract one of these great slabs. And this was simply to start the whole process. To extract a megalith, well, it would have taken a lot of people with a lot of dedication.
Today, you can still see the remains of some Neolithic monoliths that never left the quarry on the surface. And a recent excavation here, conducted in the early 2000s, revealed so much more about them.
This is what the archaeologists called Monolith 1. They excavated around it and made some exciting discoveries. They didn't find many hammer stones, which suggests that this monolith had originally been quarried further up the slope at a different outcrop. But the really exciting part was what they discovered directly underneath it. They found the remains of stone supports of an ancient trestle, upon which these Neolithic people had planned to place this monolith before exporting it out of the quarry. But disaster had struck. These stone supports had collapsed, the monolith had slipped backwards, and the whole process seems to have been abandoned, with this monolith remaining here ever since.
It's fascinating to think that some 5,000 years ago, this was an ancient quarry, where people were detaching sandstone monoliths like this one from the parent rock to be used in building monumental stone structures like the Ring of Brodgar.
But the Ring of Brodgar is situated several kilometres away from here, roughly over in that direction. These Neolithic Orcadians would have had to transport these massive monoliths, sometimes weighing as much as 10 tonnes, over a significant distance. So how did these people go about getting monoliths from a place like Vestra Fjord all the way over here to the Ring of Brodgar?
There have been a number of theories as to how people move stones in the past. I mean, sometimes people have thought that they might be floating them, but actually this loch was probably not such an open stretch of water, and it's more difficult perhaps to float a stone rather than to roll it. Recent experiments also tried sliding it on seaweed to use as a slippery
really?
Surface,
wow.
Which worked to some extent. So I think it was just sheerly the fact that they could mobilise so much labour. These projects involve a lot of planning and a lot of getting together the resources.
So does it seem that the whole process of making this ring, of getting the stones here, was more important than the actual finished purpose of the stone circle itself?
In some senses, it could be felt that the process of creating this was as unifying as the ceremonies that might have taken place after it was built.
We don't know why these Stone Age Orcadians decided to build the Ring of Brodgar here, of all places. But almost certainly, it served a communal purpose.
The finished monument would have almost undoubtedly been used for ceremonies, bringing people together. The scale of the ditch and the small size of the causeways that give access in and out is a profound sense of exclusion. So although it's not built walls as in the tombs, there is a sense that maybe the internal space, the interior of the monument, was restricted to certain people at certain times, and maybe other people were watching from the outside. Even now, if you stand in the centre, which of course you can't do now and you wouldn't do, and you make a loud sound, it bounces back to you, and that's even with the partial circle. So you can imagine that kind of acoustic effect when all the stones were there. You'd be chanting maybe or singing, and that sound would be resonating back to you. So yeah, the position is very particular.
The Ring of Brodgar is one of the great archaeological jewels in Neolithic Orkney's crown. But that stone circle over there, well, it didn't exist in isolation. It was part of a much larger landscape bustling with human activity. And here, on the nearby headland, an ongoing excavation has revealed so much more about this.
This is the Ness of Brodgar, home to one of the most significant and incredible archaeological excavations currently underway on the British Isles. The discoveries here have shed so much extraordinary light about the people of Neolithic Orkney and how they lived. To find out more about the dig, I'm meeting Dr. Nick Card.
Nick, it's really exciting to finally be at the excavation. But what do we think the Ness of Brodgar was?
Well, the Ness was in use for well over 1,000 years, in fact, over 1,200 years. So spanning the whole of the Neolithic period in Orkney. And through that 1,000 years, its meaning, its function would have changed. But if you wanted to try and encapsulate what it was in its kind of heyday, I think it was a place of gathering. Place where people came from right the way across Orkney, but also from much further afield. And what do people do when they gather? They eat. They feasted here in very grand scale.
And so what has the archaeology revealed about the layout of this site?
It's sort of almost been planned. It's not like town planning, but a lot of the structures, particularly in the phase that we're investigating just now, where you have these very large piered structures all arranged around this kind of central paved area, complete with the stump of a standing stone, that they were laid out to respect each other. But they were also contained within a major walled enclosure, which initially we thought enclosed the whole site, but we now know it just consists of a major wall at the north end facing the Ring of Brodgar, another wall at the south end, but the two bodies of water creating kind of natural boundaries for the other two sides of the site.
Nick and his team have been working at the Ness of Brodgar for some 20 years now. In total, they believe that there are probably more than 100 Neolithic structures on the site, less than half of which have been excavated. And as you walk around, you start to realise how varied these visible structures were in their size and their splendour. From monumental, immaculately looking buildings that would have rested amongst the most spectacular in Northwest Europe, to more peculiar structures like this one, complete with unusual masonry features such as these prone orthostats lying on their edge. Rich in material, the Ness is a jewel in the crown of British archaeology.
And so how important do we think the Ness of Brodgar was back in Neolithic times?
I think it was a site that was probably renowned throughout Britain. We find material culture here that came from, for instance, pitchstone, a type of volcanic glass, a bit like obsidian that's found only on the island of Arran off the southwest coast of Scotland. We find mace heads here from the western isles of Scotland. We find an axe blank from the great Neolithic axe factories in Langdale in the Lake District. Some of the pottery is most closely resembles some of the pottery from southern Britain. The art is paralleled by art from Ireland. So a whole range of different kind of influences coming in. So I think that this was a place, maybe a pilgrimage at one stage of its life. And I think we see people coming here from not just across Orkney, from much, much further afield. So it's when you look at the map of Britain and see Orkney at that kind of pivotal position right at the tip of Scotland with access to the east and west coast, I think it was very important then. And it is almost like turning the map of Britain on its head.
In its heyday, you can imagine the Ness of Brodgar being a settlement designed to awe and accommodate people venturing here from all over Orkney, Britain, and possibly beyond. This was a great centre of the Neolithic world, and even the smallest artefacts unearthed here have provided invaluable insight into what life was like 5,000 years ago.
So Roy, we've got some really interesting artefacts here. These all to do with pottery, is it?
This is all pottery. It's called grooveware pottery. It's very distinctive, and we have about 100,000 pieces of it,
wow, okay,
which is by far the biggest collection of grooveware pottery in the country. It has an interesting history. The shape of the pot is very similar. It's either straight-sided or a bit flower-potty. The oldest dates we have for grooveware, although you get it right down what's now England, and in Ireland, but the oldest dates we have are here in Orkney. Now, I'm not saying this particular site because we can't pin it down like that, but the oldest dates seem to be here, and then we can trace it on other Neolithic sites as we go south into Scotland and down to England and over to Ireland. We're not saying that people tucked a big pot under their arm and got into a boat and rowed off to Clacton and Sea or anything like that. It's the idea of the decoration, which must have really seized people's imagination. The earliest stuff was decorated with incisions, and that is patterns cut into the exterior surface of the pot with a sharp point. That pot was really well made. It was well fired. And then they moved on to cordons, applied cordons. Now, cordon is a strip of clay which they stuck onto the exterior of the pot in patterns. And then they could take little decorative slits and cuts into it as well.
As the Neolithic progressed, this cordoned grooveware pottery became the new fashion, gradually overtaking the incised Unstonware pottery we saw earlier. But one of the most striking things you notice from some of these small shards of pot is the colour.
When you think about it, there's absolutely no reason why there shouldn't be colour in the Neolithic. But you look at the site, you've seen the site, it's quite grey. So it's too easy to assume, oh well, the Neolithic must have been a bit grey as well, a bit boring. No, they had colour. This is a cordon, one of these, but it's come off. It's detached from the pot. You see, it's
got
a flat back.
Yes, yes.
They're very easy to recognise when we're digging because it's got a flat back. But it's been decorated with hematite, which is an iron ore you get in Orkney. So they've applied the hematite, and that would have been a rich red 5,000 years ago. But it's not bad now. It's pretty old, and it's still got a bit of colour to its face.
And it's also really interesting, isn't it, that you said that's hematite, that's an iron ore, mm-hmm, but they're using it for decoration hundreds and hundreds of years before the Iron Age is even a thing.
Oh, many years, yes. Many, many.
It's fascinating how small shards of seemingly insignificant pottery can give us such a valuable insight into the vibrant, colourful nature of a place like the Ness of Brodgar some 5,000 years ago. But pottery also gives us an extraordinary insight into their diet.
Yeah, we can analyse the pots to find out what they were using to hold them for, the storage, etc., but also cooking. If you find a bit of burnt, blacky stuff inside a pot, you can analyse it and you can find out what it was. Actually, we don't even have to go as far as that now because the pot is porous, it's low-fired. So if you had some meat inside it and you were cooking it, or anything indeed, It releases lipids, fats, and they soak into the wall of the pot. So all we have to do, even if we don't have any black gungy stuff, is take out a little piece of the pot wall and analyse it. And the studies we've done so far are, they're about 50-50 milk and meat. So that was their diet, though there is a problem. They were lactose intolerant, which means they couldn't take milk. It made it, people still are in some places. It bloats you up and makes you feel really rotten. So if you process it into a yogurt or a cottage cheese type of thing, you can eat it perfectly well. So we think they were processing milk as well.
And so what can this pottery tell us about the economics of this place?
Well, they can tell us that they were very largely cattle-based, although they were growing barley as well, because you can find traces of that. A lot of the methods of analysis, the scientific methods of analysis, have really improved recently. So we're hoping in the next 2 to 3 years to have some really detailed analysis of the contents of the pot. And that might bring up some surprises. There might be something else in there that we don't know about yet.
The Nessa Brodgar excavations have already revealed so much about Neolithic Orkney, and no doubt the work of the archaeologists and volunteers here will continue to unearth extraordinary artefacts in the years ahead. 5,000 years ago, this was an incredibly important meeting place, but it doesn't seem to have been a residential settlement. And that's what I want to learn more about next.
Fortunately, I've come to the right place.
In the winter of 1850, a vicious storm ravaged Orkney's coastlines. Here at Scale Bay, the tempest was so ferocious that the power of the wind and the waves ripped up the grassy earth from the top of a large group of sand dunes called Scarra Brae. But this was a blessing in disguise, because what this act of nature accidentally unveiled was absolutely astonishing. The remains of prehistoric stone buildings.
The man who investigated the remains following the storm was William Graham Watt, the local Orcadian laird living at nearby Scale House. It was Watt who instigated the first excavations here, enlisting the help of local antiquarian George Petrie.
Thankfully, we still have Petrie's report of this initial excavation. It was published some 20 years after Watt made this discovery. And I've got excerpts from the report here, and in it, Petrie mentions how, well, the ruins of Scarra Brae are altogether so different in type from any hitherto discovered. The buildings may be generally described as a group of chambers and cells arranged on both sides of and opening into a long zigzag or winding passage, which runs nearly parallel with the line of beach.
Petrie refrained from proposing a date for Scarra Brae in his report, but he did make an interesting assumption. Given the evident constructive skill of those who built Scarra Brae, Petrie assumed that such a settlement could not have been built by people who primarily used flint and stone tools, what he called rude implements. Scarra was certainly an ancient site, but Petrie assumed that it must have dated to an age of metal, to the Bronze or Iron Age.
In short, Petrie didn't believe that this settlement could date to the Stone Age. He didn't think it could be that old. He followed the common view of the time that Stone Age people weren't sophisticated enough to make something like Scarra. It was a bold assumption. Whether it would stand the test of time, however, was another matter.
More and more work at the site occurred throughout the following century by famous archaeologists such as Professor Gordon Vere Child. As the digs progressed, more and more buildings were unearthed, more artefacts were dated, conclusions started to be reached.
Petrie's initial assumption was proved wrong. This settlement did date to the Stone Age. What these archaeologists and antiquarians had uncovered in the wake of that vicious storm was the best preserved Neolithic settlement in Western Europe.
The small collection of closely connected houses you can see at Scarra Brae today is just a snapshot of the Neolithic village itself. Surveys of surrounding fields have revealed that the village was much bigger in its day, with the settlement seemingly growing in size as the Neolithic progressed. Thanks to the remarkable level of preservation at Skara, here you can get a real insight into what homely life was like for those Neolithic Orcadians living on this western coastal edge of Orkney. And Jane has kindly agreed to show me around one of these houses.
So these are the passageways, which are quite narrow and of course would have had a need to crouch to come into the building, but of course that bit's gone now, but we could do an imaginary crouch. And coming into this building, you can see these fantastic remains of the beds and the hearth.
Jane, it's incredible.
Isn't it special?
So this is the interior of a 5,000 year old residential home. This is how it was laid out.
Yes, and actually you're steered in a certain direction to walk around the hearth in the part that's slightly wider, and then you have a narrower way around there. So this is all part of the sort of way that you're made to walk around these houses, which are quite formulaic in the way they're laid out.
Well, it's incredible to actually be here and to be standing here. I mean, but first of all, what is this key feature that we've got in front of us here?
So Tristan, in front of us we have the hearth, which is always stone built, a very substantial piece of architecture and quite large in relation to the size of the floor area. Then either side you see these boxes, these stone boxes are actually beds. They're called beds and they probably were beds. And then in front of us we see the most special part of the house, the innermost rear part where the dresser is.
Oh, so that, would that have been one, would it then?
Yes, you can see the uprights of the dresser. The pillars that then held the shelves, and quite often they're a two-storey arrangement. So these are called dressers, but actually to me these are more like house altars. Sometimes there are optional extra beds, so here we have an additional one. And the other thing that you see as well are these tanks. So these are tanks or boxes.
Oh yes.
These could have held multiple types of things. So some people have said they were used to hold bait, because some of them are sealed so that you could contain water within them. And then others, Gordon Child found things like the bone beads, necklaces within them. So some of them were maybe for holding or containing precious items.
But arguably, Skara Brae's most striking feature isn't in any of the houses. It's beneath them.
So the sophistication of this architecture that we can see visibly is nothing to the sophistication of the drainage systems which underlie these villages. And this is something that you find in early Neolithic and later Neolithic villages. They have very complex drainage systems. So every part of the house is drained. There's drains for these little recesses, which is why some people have interpreted them as lavatories, perhaps they were, drains for the hearth and the beds, little drains that then all feed into larger drains which underlie the passageways, and then they all feed into much bigger drains that then take all the effluent out to the body of water, the loch probably in the past. So in this hatch, if we open it up.
Oh, wow, look at that. Drains like this are underneath the whole of the Skara Brae village.
That's right, yes. This is one of the main drains, one of the big ones that all the others would come into.
It's incredible to get this small glimpse into the secret underworld of Skara Brae, epitomising the architectural prowess of these Neolithic farmers. And the archaeology unearthed here was equally astonishing. Finely carved jewellery made out of bone, such as bead necklaces and dress pins, polished stone axe heads, and also ochre pots, still with the colour visible within. But not all objects uncovered at Skara Brae have a clear function. The purpose of some are much more mysterious, and this is especially true of one particular set of enigmatic objects, several of which are today in the National Museum of Scotland's collections.
Hugo, these have really caught my eye, these five objects here. They look absolutely extraordinary, but what exactly are they?
Well, your guess is probably as good as mine, but they are some really fine examples of sort of ground sculpted stone objects, which really don't defy often a functional interpretation. And so we have both plain balls here, we have balls here which are very sort of finely polished and decorated.
With decoration on as well,
yeah.
Can't you?
Yeah, and we know this was made probably at Scarabray because the rock it's made from is found on the beach outside the settlement.
Right. Okay, so locally made, locally produced.
Yes, but you can see the more you catch the light on it, the more you can see these fine patterns, grid-like patterns, characteristic of sort of grooved ware style designs. There's a very nice sort of diamond lattice there.
Yes, I see this decoration. So we put some time and effort into these, but it's so interesting as well. You get these rounder, smoother examples, but looking there, you get some much, much rougher ones too.
Yeah, and we also get very finely decorated forms. That's perhaps most distinctive.
Look at
that. Yes. In that you can see it's got six knobs on the surface. So this is a classic sort of carved stone ball that we find in the late Neolithic. Mostly in Aberdeenshire we find that style of carved stone ball. But there are around 20 odd examples from Orkney. And again, this one made locally of Camptonite from the local beach. You can see the way it's got little incised grooves on the surface there. But Orkney also developed its sort of own style of carved stone ball.
This one looks incredibly interesting, just because it looks so, I guess, symmetrical in a way too.
Yeah, covered in these tiny little pyramidal knobs. Very distinctive Orcadian style, but yes, exceptionally finely worked. You'll see that only one or two of the knobs have any form of damage on them at all.
What these distinctive balls were used for continues to be hotly debated.
There are dozens of theories, but we often see them interpreted as potentially being hafted as mace heads, and you find a lot of mace heads in the late Neolithic. They could deliver quite
a
blow.
That would do a lot of damage, yeah.
But again, not many of these knobs have damage on them. They could also be a toy, a game. They could also be a symbolic object, something of very much importance, symbols of power within the community, the people that hold them. But we really don't know. There are so many different interpretations, but it does seem they could well be weapons or symbolic weapons.
Even though Neolithic Orkney was a place very much interconnected with a wider prehistoric world, artifacts like these mysterious bulls showed how these people also retained their own traditions, visible within Orcadian communities like those living at Scarabray.
5,000 years ago, Scarabray was just one of many Neolithic communities in Orkney. It wasn't anything special. But fast forward to the present day, and this group of houses down there have become one of the most famous Neolithic sites in the entire world, thanks to its astonishing preservation.
There aren't many places in Orkney that can rival the stunning preservation of Scarabray. But there is one, a tomb renowned the world over.
During the early Neolithic in Orkney, tombs were defined by the so-called Orkney Cromarty cairns, stored cairns like the one we've seen at Unston. But as the Neolithic progressed, these tombs became more and more elaborate, ultimately resulting in some of the most immaculate pieces of stone architecture from anywhere in the Neolithic world. The most elaborate tomb of them all is right up ahead. This is Mace Howe, a massive chambered cairn dating to around 3000 BC. As you approach it, you already start to get a sense of its scale. The mound today is some 10 metres in height with a diameter of some 25 metres. And originally, surrounding this cairn, there would have been a stone wall and a ditch. The remains of the latter, the ditch, you can still see the outline of today.
Already, you start to get a sense that this tomb was designed to mesmerise any who laid eyes upon it. But the best is still to come.
Once you've gone through the entrance, you find yourself in this small passageway, roughly a metre in width, with these giant slabs of stone on either side. The passageway itself goes on for some 10 metres, just over 10 metres, until you emerge
into this great central stone chamber.
Chambered cairns can be found all across Orkney. But what makes Mace Howe so special is its exquisite craftsmanship.
The stonework here is absolutely incredible. It makes something like Unston Cairn pale in comparison. This central stone chamber is larger than any of Mace Howe's Orcadian counterparts, but it's in the walls where you start to really see the quality of this tomb. These walls are dry stone, so they were made without mortar. And you'll notice how they start lower down vertical. But as the wall gets further up, you'll notice how they start to curve inwards until they would ultimately have joined with the other side to form a roof. It's a construction technique called corbelling. It's an impressive feat of engineering. These Neolithic Orcadians, well, they were farmers, but they were also builders too. And it's only in a place like here that you really get a real sense of that. In the walls, you notice these squares leading off to smaller chambers called cells. There are three of them in total here at Mace Howe. And in each of the corners, you'll notice these stones protruding from the wall, each with their own monolith. Now, originally, it was thought that these stones were to serve as buttresses to support the whole stone structure, but no longer. It's now believed that these served no structural purpose whatsoever. They were just for show. It's hard to fathom how much time and effort, how many people, how much monumental stone material it would have taken to build a cairn like Mace Howe. This was a tomb designed to impress, to awe, to amaze.
Who Mace Howe was meant to amaze is a difficult question to answer.
Almost certainly, Mace Howe was designed to be a tomb to house a prominent figure or family in later Neolithic Orkney. But as you make your way out of the cairn, you start to realise how this structure would have been very closed off. For instance, this large triangular slab of stone here would have been used to seal the passageway to bar entry.
And further out too, you had a deep surrounding ditch as well as a stone wall. Unlike at the Ring of Brodga, there were no causeways across this massive ditch. If these outer constructions were made at the same time as Mace Howe, then those building this tomb were determined to seal it off from the rest of the Orcadian world as soon as the building was complete.
If this was the case, could it be that the people who this tomb was meant to amaze were the builders themselves? That the communal process of constructing this monumental tomb and the authority such a process provided for those overseeing its construction was just as, if not more important, than the tomb's final purpose. It's possible, although we'll never know for sure, but one thing is for certain. With contemporary Neolithic settlements all around, chambered tombs like Mace Howe would have remained incredibly noticeable in the landscape for centuries following their initial construction. Visible houses of the dead, spirits of the ancestors.
Chambered tombs like Mace Howe are some of the finest monumental structures that survive from the Stone Age. Stunning examples that evoke the stone-working prowess of these prehistoric people by the early 3rd millennium BC. But stone would not remain the prime material of choice for much longer. By roughly 2500 BC, great change was on the horizon in Orkney. It was the dawn of the Bronze Age. For a long time, the end of the Neolithic was seen as a period when Orkney's prominence decreased due to the noticeable lack of monumental Bronze Age architecture that survives here compared with the preceding Stone Age. But now, that view is changing.
Well, I think all too often that the Bronze Age in Orkney is seen as this kind of retro step happening, that, you know, suddenly the grandeur of the Neolithic is replaced by this almost kind of ephemeral Bronze Age presence. But it's not. We still find, you know, fantastic burial monuments across the islands, like the Nausa Trotti, just across the Loch Ahari, where there was gold discs and amber beads discovered in a massive Bronze Age burial tomb. I think it was just a different emphasis happening in society in the Bronze Age, where it was much more to do with the individual rather than the larger community.
The Stone Age in Orkney had reached its end, but the importance of its great structures endured.
All these monuments continued to be very much parts of the landscape. It wasn't suddenly at the end of the Neolithic that they were ceased to be recognised. And for instance, the stones of Stenness, we find much later Iron Age activity at the stones. So they're still parts of the local lifestyle, mythology almost.
So these stone structures constructed in the Neolithic, their legacy lives on even down into the Bronze Age and further on from then.
I think like all the monuments here, their legacy lives on right to the present day. And even when you look at kind of the myths and legends of Orkney within the historic period, a lot of them relate to these monuments. And everybody puts their own interpretation on them.
We might think of Orkney as a place on the periphery, but some 5,000 years ago, this was a great centre. An important hub with connections that stretched across Britain, Ireland and beyond. A place where beliefs, ideas and practices originated and spread across the known world. Home to some of the most iconic and immaculate Stone Age structures from anywhere in the world.
But for me, what's been most interesting of all has been learning more about the people who made these monumental structures. Looking at artifacts that have revealed more about how they lived. Objects that are adding more colour to the lives of these ancient people who lived here some 5,000 years ago, all at the heart of a golden age in the story of prehistoric Scotland.
Orkney's extraordinary Neolithic is a fascinating tale in the story of Scotland's prehistoric past. But this is only the beginning. As the years went on and the trade of metals increased, great change would start to occur all across northern Britain.
New people would arrive on Scotland's shores, bringing their own objects, beliefs and practices with them. New centres of trade and connectivity would rise, and it's to one of the most extraordinary of these emerging centres, some 200 miles south of here, that we'll be heading to next.